Welcome to Coffee and Change. I'm Bill Kirst. As a business professional, a U.S. veteran, a lifelong learner, and an active listener, I help others navigate, understand, and adapt to our ever-changing workplace and world. As a third culture kid, I call many places home. Presently, Seattle is where I explore my creativity through the power of words and images. In this podcast, we journey with our guests, gaining knowledge and inspiration from their stories.
Hello and welcome back. Thanks for listening. I believe each one of us has a book inside us. And last year, on August 8th, I published my first book. Well, unbeknownst to me then, a week later, a gentleman named Jim Fielding published his first book, All Pride, No Ego. And I had no idea then how much I'd need the story now. In fact, his memoir, his book, was the book I needed to read 25 years ago. I'm excited and honored to bring Jim Fielding onto the podcast to share his incredible story.
Jim, thank you so much for joining the Coffee and Change podcast. I am really thrilled that we finally get to connect and I get to hear a little bit about your story and this incredible book that, believe it or not, you published 7 days after I published my first book.
Oh my gosh. Isn't that fun? So. Oh my God, I have to get that. I have to get that now. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
Yeah. So let's start off. First of all, let me just say that this book that you've written was the book I needed 25 years ago.
Mm. Like, I love that.
Hands down, needed 25 years ago. And here we are in the world that we're in today. And even though we feel like the world has advanced and we've gotten more modern and accepting, in many ways, it's the book we need right now. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how this came to you. And really, like, why it's so important now to share this autobiographical story of this incredible out leader who is literally changing corporations, companies, but also lives. So let's start there.
Well, I mean, I love that you picked up on that. I mean, the funny thing is about the book, and I think the unlock to writing the book for me was when my editor said, I was 56 when I wrote the book, and she said, write the book that 25, 26-year-old Jim wished he would have had when I was struggling with many personal and professional issues early in my career. And so I love that you picked up on that because it literally became a cathartic, almost selfish exercise to go through because it's literally the book that I wish I'd found on the shelf when I was younger in my career. And I think, unfortunately, to your point, it took on a greater sense of urgency. To be honest with you, Bill, it was supposed to come out in spring of 24, like right now. And as the editors were looking at it and, you know, the powers that be at John Wiley were looking at it, they're like, we need to get this out sooner because we kind of knew the election cycle was going to be ugly again. I don't think we totally knew it was going to be 2020 redo, but, and so I worked really hard. Like, they moved up my timetable, basically, as you know, because you've written a book. All of my deadlines moved up. And they said, can you do it? And I said, I'll try. And we did it. And I'm so glad that we did because I, even though it's a book I basically wrote to myself, I do think, unfortunately, it's really timely because our community is under probably more attack now than it's been, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years. And I think, you know, when we got the right to marry, I think as a community, we almost exhaled a little bit. And I'm not saying we got lazy, but I think we thought, okay, we're okay. And I think what's happened in the last 2, 3, 4 years has reminded us that we have to fight the fight every day for social justice and essential human rights. And so the book is enabling me to have that conversation.
Yeah, you know, I find it really interesting how you describe, and I think it's really important for people to understand that discussion that took place between you and the publisher and the editor, which was, hey, if we're going to look at a crystal ball here, 2024 could be a different but repeat challenge of 2020, and we really need to have stories out there that bring the humanity back to the center. Am I hearing that right?
Completely. I mean, it was... I mean, like, you know, why write the book? I say in the book, representation matters. And I think I also say in the book, just by living my life, you become an activist and you become an advocate. And as I grew up without role models like myself, and by the way, I'm not saying anybody should role model me, but I didn't have anybody that looked like me or was doing what I did, you know, in my life. I realized that, particularly with the attacks that are on the queer community and especially the trans community, we needed to be telling our stories again and sharing our stories openly and without fear so that people knew they weren't alone. You know, because I spent a lot of my life, as you know, because I know you listened and read the book, feeling alone and feeling like I was the only one who felt this way. And once you embrace your authenticity and realize there's a lot of people that feel your way and you find your community, it makes your journey easier. I'm not saying easy, but easier. So I appreciated my editor and the executive editor and, you know, the Wiley powers that be that saw that and were reading the early chapters and saying, okay, you're onto something here and we need to get this out.
Yeah, I'm grateful too, because, you know, everything sort of comes into your life when it needs to. But I think the other part, which is really interesting, and I encourage people who pick up the book or listen to the book, and I definitely want to put in a plug for the Audible version, because to hear you read your own words is a very, very powerful experience. And I will just caution people that read it and or listen to it. I had to slow read this and then slow listen to it for a couple of reasons, Jim. And I think you understand why. It brought up a lot of emotion in me. Like specifically when you talk about the mythos, and I'm using that word very intentionally, of Fieldings never lie. And I'm getting a little emotional about this, but I mean, when you talked about that and it was, you know, it's almost something that the reader or listener might miss in your preface, right? But the world stopped moving when I heard that part of the book, because that's exactly the way in which I was brought up. And when you are from this tribe that says things like that to and are very true, like we don't lie, right? We put integrity at the highest value, and then our mere existence is in conflict with that. Carrying that around for years and years and decades, like this is why I had to slow read and slow listen, because it like gravity left the earth. You know what I mean? Like you just find yourself in those moments.
Wow. Like, I mean, okay. We're only 7 minutes in and you're getting your Oprah moment. Like now you've got me crying. I think that dichotomy of being raised, you know, with that very strong kind of Midwestern, you know, religious, not even religious, but spiritual, just like very clear morals and ethics, but identifying early that we were so hypocritical about it. Like, you know, we were all saying that. And then, you know, we had my mom's situation that I talk about, you know, and her alcoholism. And then I was struggling with my own lie. And, you know, but we were literally walking around proudly, like feelings don't lie. We're so transparent. We're so direct. We're so honest. And, you know, the thing that I tear up about is what I realized in writing the book was I just lost a childhood, right? Like I had to grow up so fast because of my mom's situation that I was like a little old man too early. Like I was dealing with real world burdens and challenges that nobody knew. I mean, I think one of the most amazing things, Bill, about this book is my friends from Toledo, Ohio, where I grew up, who have literally called me and said, I had no idea, zero idea. And I said, that's because we were doing our job, right? Like we were literally coached and told by our father, by our mother, this is our issue. This is family. Like we don't share family secret. And for some reason that wasn't called lying. That was just called not sharing. Right. And, you know, I tell a story in the book. I know because you listen slowly, like, you know, my grandmother giving me the Serenity Prayer when I was 10 years old with zero context, right? Like hands me this card that I still have today in my book, you know, in my memento box, but literally hands it to me. And of course, I'm old enough to read it and kind of understand it, but like zero context, like zero of, and again, because she knew my mom had a problem. It was her daughter. And yet she couldn't sit me down and say, your mother has a problem. We're going to work with her on it. And we're going to also, by the way, Jimmy, we're going to get you help. Instead, just read this prayer over and over again. And that's going to solve everything. Right. And I write in the book, it took me till I was in my 30s and I went to Al-Anon because of a partner addiction issue. Mm-hmm. I literally, in my first Al-Anon meeting, we closed with the Serenity Prayer. And I'm like, I have been saying that since I was 10 years old and didn't know what it was. Yeah. Like, and again, I should have, when I was younger, I should have gone to Alateen. I should have, I should have had counseling. But in the 70s, when I was growing up, it didn't exist. I mean, it existed, but it wasn't anything. And by the way, that would have had to be acknowledging that mom had a problem, the family had a problem, and we weren't going to do that. But I just think it's so, again, writing the book, it gives you the benefit of hindsight. I'm like, my grandmother gave me that flipping card. But literally it was like, she was at our house for dinner. And after dinner, she's like, here, I got something for you. Right. I'm like,
that's
I'm
how it happens in these
like, I think it's going to be a $5 bill, right? Like I'm going to get a little tip for something. And she hands it to me. I didn't get rid of it though. That's what's interesting is there was something about that card and the simplicity of the Serenity Prayer that I held on to my whole life. But, oh my gosh, I wish I would have had a different support network back then.
You know, I really appreciate that you talk about this so freely in the book as well as now, because I'm also an adult child of an alcoholic. And your,
that's where we bond.
Your story, I mean, again, it's for those of us that know and have this, right, these genes, right? They're totally. they're in our heritage. And
yes.
I also grew up very, very quickly. And so when I was reading and listening to your story, I felt such a kinship immediately because I was realizing, like, I know what Jimmy then and Billy then and Jim now and Bill now, I know what that is like. And I remember, being in college, and you know, by this time I'm also the oldest boy, right? So I'm one of six kids, so I'd taken care of all the younger siblings, like you describe, right?
Yeah.
I gotta take care of the little ones because
shield them from it. Yeah.
That's right. And you talk about that, the importance of that. And I never knew a world where I was not taking care of at least three to five other people. And so I go off to college, Jim, and you're supposed to just take care of me, myself, and I. And I failed miserably. Like I could not do it. And I remember I was a junior in college and I applied to be a residential advisor. And all of a sudden I found my stride again because I was taking care of 120 other
people. You knew how to be a caretaker.
And I over-indexed on that. And I remember my elder sibling, so I'm the oldest boy, and then the oldest girl of the six had just had a baby. Right, welcomed her first child, and she comes to visit me in college, in my junior year, and she essentially has an intervention with me. Now, it's not an intervention for alcohol, but it's an intervention for an ACOA, right?
Totally, caretaker anonymous, right?
Caretaker anonymous. And so she came in, and her daughter, who's my goddaughter, an amazing, beautiful young woman, who's now studying at the London School of Economics, and I'll see her in about a month in Iceland. But
so funny.
She's an infant in her arms. And she says to me, Bill, I refuse to leave your dorm room until you agree to go to counseling. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm great. Life is good. I'm taking care of 120 young souls down the hall, you know? And she said, that's just it. Like, you've never stopped and you are going to burn out. And all of these people that are relying on you are going to fall in your midst. And
you're gonna have a breakdown. You're gonna have a breakdown.
Yeah. And I was what, 19, 20 years old?
God bless her.
God bless her. Thank my sister for that. And she refused to leave until I said, okay, I agree. And that began my journey with understanding ACOA and understanding what it means to be a carrier of that trauma.
A survivor of that. We're survivors of a generational trauma. And you know, I write in the book, I mean, I'm so envious that you had the oldest. Like, I didn't want to be the oldest, right? I literally wrote in the book, I wanted to be a middle. I didn't think being the baby was great, but I wanted to have an older sibling, brother or sister, who was taking some of the burden and could have done what she did. Like, I wish I had someone do that for me. And it ended up being my younger sister that did it, but in an ironic twist, it's when she birthed her first child and mom was like at the height of her alcoholism. And we ended up, I mean, I hate to say this, but we used the child as a wedge because we were never going to leave mom alone with her granddaughter, right? Who also ironically is my goddaughter. And, and we were never like literally never going to leave mom alone with my sister's daughter, my niece. And, I think the grandchildren, it took to the second grandchild actually to get my mom into treatment finally and get her into sobriety. But again, my younger sister, I think when they become a mother, right, their maternal protective instincts are so strong.
Yeah.
And she was just like, okay. And she acknowledged, you've been protecting me my whole life. I'm a mama bear now. I have a husband. It's about us, but I'm going to take care of you. And I actually felt like a weight off my shoulders because I think for so many years I had been carrying that burden alone.
Yeah.
And for her to say, I gotcha. And we're going to do this together. And we literally, I mean, we've always been super close, but our dynamic changed with the arrival of the grandchildren, the nieces and now, you know, fast forward, you know, almost 20 years, my mom got sober on my 39th birthday, that now we're managing mom's dementia and we're managing mom's assisted living. But it's because we have this base from the last 20 years that we're even able to do that, we're able to manage that productively and not without, you know, arguing and getting in each other's face. Like that to me, you have multiple siblings. I only have one, but that sibling relationship is one of the most important relationships.
It's paramount. Yeah. It's paramount. I cannot imagine life without them. And we have these strong bonds. And I do want to say also, like, if you can say to Jill, your sister, thank you so much, Jill. I mean, when I was reading and listening to the book, when you were describing,
she's a superstar.
I mean, I could literally picture when your mom was driving on I-70 and Jill's in the car and you're in the front seat and you're about to like, you're nauseous.
Vomit.
And you're trying to tell your
vomitorium,
mom.
Vomitorium, right? Yeah.
And
no, the poor thing. I mean, God bless her. I mean,
she's nudging your seat. She's totally like, in your like
she's like pushing me over the edge. No, I mean, I knew from the day she came in, right? I remember when she came home, like I knew my life was going to change because I was going to be a big brother. And it's literally like one of the joys of my life. And it's so funny because now that the girls are older, you know, she has one daughter is working and living away from home. The other one's a junior in college who ironically is in Denmark and I'm going in 2 weeks to visit
really?
Her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's an overseas study.
Yeah.
I said to my sister, cause my fiance and I were there and for Christmas in December and the girls weren't home. We kind of went a week before Christmas. And I said, you know, I love your girls, but I love us being us again. Like it's you and me and our husbands and you and I get to go off and go shopping and go have coffee and to have her back as just my sister and a human being and not the mom, you know, and not have to talk about the kids' soccer schedule or, you know, lessons and all that kind of stuff. I said, I love those girls to death, but I'd love having you back, you know, to myself. And we're excited as a foursome to like travel and spend time together. because let's face it, she knows me better than anybody on earth. And writing the book, I couldn't have done the book without her permission, because
of course,
by telling her participation also, but I knew by telling my story, I was basically telling her story, and that we had to be ready for that. She was great. She was an early reader. She kind of got it at a chapter at a time, and was super honest. Of course, she always is. She's a truth teller for sure. And, you know, there was many times during the process I said, if we're uncomfortable with this, I won't do it. Or we'll wait until mom passes away. Or, you know, I might never ever do it. Like, this is not, you know, the only thing I have going in my life. And she's like, no, you have to do this. You have to do this. She never wavered.
Yeah. I also, so your mom's still with you,
yes,
right? Okay. So, and I know you said, you know, she's suffering dementia and you guys are working through that. I also want to say from me to your mom, thank you. Because the way that she responded, the way that you expressed how she responded, where she pulled the car over, she hugged you. She said, I've known for a long time. I've just been waiting for you to tell me. There are many, many, many of us who wished we had that experience. Mm-hmm. And when we hear stories like this, there goes the voice, right? You start to get emotional. Yeah. When we hear stories like this, it heals in a way that we don't expect. And so what's really interesting is we place ourselves in other people's stories. So I found myself, you know, we're probably 10 years apart, you and I, right? And so I placed myself, as I was listening to your audiobook version of the story, in a 1977 Vista Cruiser Oldsmobile with the wood paneling in the front seat. And I'm picturing the conversation happening from my mom to me. Now, obviously, my experience was not that, right?
Yeah.
Many people did not have that experience.
Yeah.
But there's something healing about the retelling of your story and listening to it and us being able to place ourselves in that for just a moment and feel that reunion and that unconditional
the healing.
Love.
Yeah. Oh. Like the almost like a whole. And I think, which you understand the nuance of, she was an active alcoholic at that time, right? And so I was having huge manic depressive issues with her and episodes with her. But when I needed her, to your point, she was 1,000% there. And while we're thanking people, we have to thank like Phil Donahue and Oprah Winfrey and like, because I didn't realize how much research she was doing. I didn't realize that she had actually gone out and found books and watched episodes of Phil Donahue and Oprah and other talk shows, Sally Jesse Raphael, like,
oh my God, yes.
that covered the topic that, and I think through them, she learned I had to come to her. Like, she wasn't allowed to confront me and say, you know, do you have something to tell me? Like, she would have never done that. And so, you know, again, my sister was pushing me, but I think when I felt that it was time, I mean, she was 1,000% there and never wavered. And even, you know, I wrote in the book, Bill, like I caused so many marital issues between my parents because she was so much farther ahead on it than he was. And they already had their issues because of her disease and, you know, and that next, you know, 14, 18 months was really hard because I felt the wedge that I had driven between them. And I put my sister in a horrible situation. I put my mom in a horrible situation. And that's ultimately when I had to confront my dad, basically. Yeah. And then I lost him for a year. You know, then it was like a year of estrangement. But I tell that story, especially for the young people. And again, not everybody has the story. I'm so aware of that. But I do try to tell that story that it is possible that, like, even though you go through this valley of despair and a year of not being able to talk to your father, frankly, not really being able to communicate with your family because of your father's resistance. And then when he turned the corner, you know, I say in the book, by the end of his life, he could have been the president of PFLAG, right? He literally, so you can teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, this is a lifelong blue collar, you know, proud Republican, Reagan Republican, who would stand up for gay rights vocally and verbally. And frankly, I write in the book, he was mayor of Port St. Lucie. I think part of why he didn't get reelected was he was so honest about his support for social rights and civil rights for all, that I think he lost some votes for that. But he never, like, I said to him, do not put me in your campaign material. Like, I knew where he lived. I was like, I'm not offended. And he, there I was in his, you know, at the time, you know, my son lives in California, he and his partner, like, he did not hide a thing in his campaign bio or his campaign stuff. And I'm not saying I cost him the election, but I was so proud of him that he didn't back down from it. And really to the end of his life was so, so supportive. But it was an education process for him. Yeah. And what I wrote in the book, a little bit, even when I went through my sister, Bill, you know this, it was more fear than anything else. It was not, once he was able to say that to me, that the feelings were fear-based and fear and concern for me, not anger or not acceptance, which again, hello, Dad, could you have said that at 25? It would have been a little bit easier, right? But once I was like, oh, he's protecting me.
Yes.
He doesn't dislike me. He's actually protecting me. It changed everything. And, you know, we just lost him too young. I wish he was here for the book. I wish he would have loved this process and the book tour and everything that's going on. He would have loved it. I would have taken him on the tour. Like I would, he was a great, he'd be fun on stage. He was fun.
You know, it's just so interesting because as it's affirming to hear you confirm the things I felt while I was reading the book, because our stories are so similar. Now granted, I came out to my family when I was 30, and and what's really interesting is the mom reaction and the dad reaction were almost identical to my experience. Now what was unique in my walk of life was I was also in the military. And so I was serving under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I was a captain in the Army at the time, and you know, as you described it, your father's dissonance was fear-based for you, for your success, for your safety, for your health.
Totally.
And my father's is and was and is, because, you know, we still haven't really reconciled on this particular thing, difference of how he sees the world. But it became evident to me that he was very worried that I would lose my job. That I would lose my clearance, that I would lose my status, that I would be discharged from the military. And slowly but surely over time, as you know, Jim, we actually became more successful in our careers. And you talk about this in the book as well. And it's
becomes a superpower. Like,
all of this adversity that we had to face, all of this living a dual life, all of this compartmentalization made us, and you allude to this a little bit, and even in the preface, right? That started when we had to be the best little boy in the world, right? And we perfected that. That is a craft. And I will tell people this. I tell people this in my own story. It is probably the superpower I am least proud of now.
Oh, totally.
The fact that you and I could literally excel in careers, in progress, in potential, in earning, in degrees, you name it. And we did it because we were constantly in fear of somebody finding out. And if they found out, then they might, you know, say, well, you don't belong here, which meant we had to make sure our work and our work ethic and our quality of work was indisputable.
Yeah, we were holding ourselves to a much higher standard than our peers. We were seeking external validation, right? Because we were not loving ourselves internally.
Right.
And so a promotion or a bonus or a good review was a drug to us in a way, right? Like that was our addiction, was like external validation. And I remember even with my dad, as we were going through the mending process, like I would tell him, which was kind of weird, but like when I would get a raise, I would tell him how much I made because I wanted him to know that I was okay. Right. Yeah. And it wasn't that I was bragging, but it was like, Dad, like I am doing something right. If they gave me this title or they gave me this job or look, you know, like, look what I did. And, you know, when I became president of Disney Store, I think it became really tangible to him because I could take him to store openings. Right. I could actually we went on a Disney cruise and he was like, oh my God, look at the way they're treating you. I'm like, Dad, that's because I'm president of Disney the president. Store, right? Yeah, that's why you're getting the free chocolate chip cookie sundae, right? Yeah. Like, that's why you got the upgraded room, right? Like, and it was stuff that would have never mattered to him, but at the same time, he loved it because it was an indication that I was okay. And I think because of our age difference, the other thing with my dad's fear besides career was that he thought he was going to get sick. Like,
yes.
And because he was a first responder as a fireman,
yes.
He was dealing with it. And he was watching people be very sick from HIV and AIDS. And so I think he also thought because of my lifestyle, I was going to get sick and I was mm-hmm. going to die. And I think the hardest thing, Bill, and you know, is what I had to educate my dad on much more than my mom was that it was not a choice, right? Yeah. That it was not some, like, I think he thought I had been molested or somehow as a child, like he was looking for this root cause because my dad was such a scientist, you know, he was an arson investigator. He loved chemistry. My dad was so data driven mm-hmm. that he wanted a marker. Like he wanted to know like what happened. Like, did one of your friends teach you this? And when I kept saying, Dad, it's who I am. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if I have a different chromosome. I don't know, but I don't know. Like, I don't know if I have something else in my brain. But that was the path he had to go on. He had to go on that I was not choosing this lifestyle, that it had been chosen for me. And which was different than my mom. I think my mom truly was unconditional and was like, you're my son, you're my only son, you're my firstborn, I love you no matter what. Mm-hmm. Dad had to kind of get there through science in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's also interesting because the experience my mom had, it was very interesting to see, to your point, the wedge that happened between them. Mm. The minute I came out and I realized they were in different places on it slightly. The wedge you describe so well was present. And that was something I then carried for the remainder of the years until my mom, you know, my mom passed in 2020. And one of the interesting things, my mom's biggest fear was that I would die alone.
Yeah.
And the reason being, and you understand this because we're sort of this generation, right?
Generation, yeah.
My mom grew up in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, right? 40s, 50s and 60s. And so her understanding, and you even use this term, which I love because I heard this growing up, her understanding, she heard these terms like he's a little light in the loafers, right? Mm-hmm. And, or, you know,
he's fey.
They would say these things when she was growing up in Hollywood. And we all know now about a lot of those actors, Cary Grant, you know, Rock Hudson. We all know that they had this double life. But what was most pronounced to my mom was that they died alone.
Totally sad and alone.
And if you know, for those that have even seen the recent Rock Hudson documentaries, you know, I didn't realize that, for example, when he was dying in Paris and they wanted to bring him back to the States, and this is the height of the AIDS crisis, nobody would take him on a plane.
Yeah.
And his estate essentially had to buy or rent an entire 747 from Air France with nobody else on it, put him on it on a hospital bed to get him back to the United States. That is how fearful and you know, discriminatory the world was at the time. And so those were the stories that my mom had in her head as someone who grew up in Hollywood. And she immediately, her fear went to, I don't want you to die alone. And once I met her in that fear and then showed her that quite the opposite, I've actually got an incredible person in my life who loves me more than anyone could imagine. And then she started to get to know that person over time. She realized you're not gonna be alone.
It's so parallel. I love that. I mean, it's sad that it's so parallel, but I had to have the conversation with my parents when I moved to San Francisco and I wanted them to come visit. And they did, to their credit, but I had to have the conversation with them that, like, at that point in my life, I had been to more funerals than they had been to. That's like, right. I needed them to, not that I wanted a badge of honor, but I needed them to understand the context. I also told them, you know, again, with me being 10 years older, you know, I moved to San Francisco in the early 90s. There was only two or three dentists that would even take you if you were an out gay person. And that was in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So the wait list was huge. Like, I got in with the dentist And I loved him. I still remember that relationship so well. I think a couple friends helped me like jump a couple spaces on the line to get in because I was having a tooth problem. And but that was early 90s and we were still dealing with, and that was in San Francisco in our own community. But people were so afraid of the disease for legitimate reasons. It was devastating. But bringing my parents to San Francisco in 1993 and showing them the AIDS quilt, and we delivered, I was delivering meals and I took my mom and dad on the route with me one day. I just wanted them to understand it, you know? And I felt like once we got over the bad stuff, I did realize it was my job to educate them because they weren't going to get it in Port St. Lucie, Florida or Toledo, Ohio. They were not going to get the education. And it was up to me to educate them because the one thing I knew about my family, and I talk about in the book, is we were lifelong learners and we loved reading.
Yeah.
And I knew that if I educated them, again, my dad was so fact-based that he would then be able to argue it in his own mind, but again, defend us, you know, as a community. And when he started to hear even his friends or people in his life say factual incorrect things about our community, he would correct them. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just like, I have a gay son, I know it all. Like he really was learned. And thank God for that.
Yeah. There's I think that it gives me such hope for, the lifelong learner. I also come from a long line of lifelong learners. And even in the way you describe the importance of books and bookstores and the smell of bookstores and magazines and journals. And like, again, you are a great storyteller. You know this, but you need to know this from those of us that really, you transport people. So like,
that's so nice.
I was reminded so much of one of our favorite bookstores in Galway, Ireland, when I was growing up, because I had the opportunity to grow up around the world. Both my parents were Navy, but it was my father's business work that took him all over the world. And we used to spend summers in Ireland, in the west coast of Ireland. Mm. And there's not much to do in early 90s, like literally 1991 in the west coast of Ireland when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
And so we would go into Galway, the largest, you know, city where we were. And there was this one bookstore, and it was an incredible bookstore, like right out of a movie. You would love it. And my mom and dad, you would totally love it. My mom and dad used to say when we were growing up, when it came to books, you can get as many as you want. Like there was no limit. So we would spend 8 hours in this bookstore just meandering and looking and wandering. And then we'd all realize we were hungry and we'd be like, oh, I guess it's time to go home. But we'd have an armful of books.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about like the power of that, not only from the standpoint of lifelong learning, but these were also the places where we found our own stories.
Totally.
These are the places where we found our own healing. So I would,
where we could escape to.
Yeah. Like it was a world that was created by words. And I know that you and I both being published authors know how important that is, but reflecting back on that now, I would just love to know, like you're doing book tours and you're in bookstores reading and meeting people. Is it, I don't know, like what's that experience like now contributing to that ecosystem that nourished you so much growing up?
It's overwhelming. I mean, I feel, I feel like it's a way of giving back and thanking the bookstore community, particularly the independent bookstore community. Yeah. Nothing against Barnes & Noble because I've done some incredible events at Barnes & Noble. But, the best events have been at Magic City Bookstore in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just beautiful entrepreneurial, sometimes family, many year owned. The bookstore I work with here in Atlanta is called Acapella Books, and they've been around over 20 years, and husband and wife own it, and they've been so gracious about supporting the book. And a lot of people who want signed books, that's where I fulfill them through. And it's made me, I mean, it's funny you say, because it's, as I think down the road, it's made me realize that I might want to open a bookstore, because I am a retailer. I am a shopkeeper at heart. But it wouldn't just be books. It would be, I think it's the community aspect of the bookstore that I love, and I literally, when I'm on the plane between these tour stops, I'm like you know, drawing things and writing things and thinking, oh, I'd want it to have art, and I want it to have music, and I'd want it to have journals and pens and things like that. Because I think what bookstores represented to me, yes, the place where I could find something to escape, but it also was a community. Like, it really was about being in community with people. And so my favorite ones, and I think you're up to your point about Galway. I think European bookstore, no offense against the US, because we have some amazing ones, but some of those European bookstores, it's like unbelievable. And, you know, and on, when I go to Europe, when I go anywhere, even when I go to Asia, yes, I'll go to museums. Yes, I'll go shop fashion and all that, because that's part of my job, but I'll always find bookstores. And I, and listen, I buy from Amazon too. I get what Amazon is for. But I just really want to help protect those independent bookstores. And that's why the tour, and honestly, I don't care if 5 people show up or 50 people show up. I think it's just, like being, again, in community in those bookstores, I realize what they represent. So I always am playing with that idea down the road.
I love that. I also love the fact that, I mean, in the book you talk about creating magical moments, and I think it's really, it's also important for me to say, we grew up a Disney family, right? Like, totally. So everything was, I mean, we, gosh, do you remember when they used to release the VHSs from the vault?
Like, oh God, yeah.
These were like
line up. You would line
moments
up
like, in our life.
Totally. No, we'd reserve them. I remember we'd go reserve them. And I think, you know, when we were cleaning out my mom's house with this move, my sister and I found so many VHS. We're like, what do you do with those now? Right. And then I have DVDs, because like when I worked at Disney, it was the DVD world. And so I have like boxes and boxes of the DVDs. For sure. I mean, we were a Disney family. I wrote in the book, we went to Orlando in 1971, the year it opened.
Yeah.
I don't know how my parents afforded it. I know we didn't stay on property. I remember we stayed at the Days Inn in Kissimmee, Florida. And I thought it was called Kissimmee, but it's Kissimmee. And I have such vivid memory. I was 6 years old, and I have such vivid memories of that. And so the fact that I ended up working there was such a weird, you know, Lion King circle of life moment.
Yeah.
I think my mom and dad thought they'd died and gone to heaven, you know, because the discounts and the cruises and the, you know, my nieces were like the perfect age, because they went through the princess phase, and then they went through like the Hannah Montana Wizard of Waverly Place High School Musical phase, all when I was there. Like, I love looking back at those pictures. I remember one year, my older niece was Sharpay from High School Musical for Halloween, and was like living her best life being Sharpay. Like, and to be able to provide that was amazing.
Yeah, it's also so, like the stitching and the weaving of the stories is so fascinating to me, because my parents, one of their first dates was to Disneyland. And so,
it's
just
such
woven
a
in.
Moment. Like, to work at a company like that, where it's such a part of so many people's histories and family histories, is a tremendous, tremendous feeling. But at the same time, it comes with a lot of responsibility, because we had to have that standard, because we're participating in these people's lives. And you know, when I was president of Disney Store, one of my favorite things was we did a lot of wish granting for the Make-A-Wish kids.
Donate.
And I mean, we took those so seriously, and wanting to make a memory, not only for the wish child itself, but for themselves, but for the entire family. And my team would go above and beyond on those wish fulfillments, like and it wasn't only that, it was kids with birthdays and everything else, but the wish kids were really special.
You know, I was very fortunate. I had a colleague years ago who worked on the Make-A-Wish Foundation in Washington State and Oregon. So it was Washington, Alaska, and Oregon. I think they combined them. And she was also a consultant, and we were very successful consultants, and we did what we did really well. And she started a campaign essentially through our consulting company to say, hey, we're going to, you know, raise some airline miles for some families, right, to get this child to Disney World, right? That's their dream. They want to do the whole thing. Well, when you give a consultant a challenge, they rise to the challenge. And she did this, and it turned out that she was able to get not only miles for the child to go, but we raised enough miles that the child, her entire family, and several of her aunts and uncles and cousins could go. So it ended up being like an entire family tribe that went to Disney World. And I remember when those pictures came back and they were sent around the company, it was like, I don't think there was a single person not crying.
No, that's so rewarding. And, you know, the interesting thing when you go back and look at those pictures, Bill, is look at the non-sick children in the family.
Yes,
because that's I think we so underestimated them. Of course, we wanted the ill child, the wish child, as we called them, to have an amazing moment. But the problem for the other children, the not ill children in a family, is they really were an ill child takes so much focus from both parents. And, you know, particularly if they have a life-threatening illness or a terminal illness. And the other kids, of course, care about their siblings, but they miss out on stuff. And so I always looked at the joy on the brothers and sisters' faces.
Yeah.
Not only the child themselves, because that was one thing I loved about Disney overall, not just Disney Store, but we always granted complete family wishes. So it meant if the child made that wish, everybody came. Grandparents, siblings, parents, and that's why it was my favorite job. Those years were my favorite job by far.
You know, it's also funny because a lot of people don't know this story, and I love sharing these little stories that people don't know about me. But one of the jobs I almost took out of college, my parents were not happy at this idea because I graduated Johns Hopkins University in 2000, you know, not a small accomplishment. And I had a job offer from Disney to work on Castaway Key, which is the island.
Oh, yes.
The island where the cruise ship goes
to.
And at the time, you probably could keep me honest here, but at the time, they needed people who spoke multiple languages. So I was fortunate to learn 6 languages growing up. And there was this job where I would have worked on Castaway Key, and I would have been kind of a translator and
a host, experience
curator, right? And the hardest part, they said, so the biggest challenge of this job is you're only going to get mail, like postal mail, like every other week or something, because like it's when the cruise comes in. And I was like, that's not a problem. And I was so ready to do this job. And then I was explaining to my parents, like, I'm going to go be this like Castaway Key translator curator. And they're like, the hell you are.
Is that a real job? They were like, is that real?
Yeah.
No,
I studies degree and go work at Castaway Key.
It's so funny. Cause we went on one of those family cruises where we went to Castaway Key. And I remember we got off that first Disney cruise, and it was when I was president of Disney Store. And I remember looking at my family, my parents, my sister, my niece, you know, sister, her husband, the nieces, and everybody was like, that was my favorite vacation of life. And I remember I called the president of the cruise line, like when I got back in the office, and I said, you literally are producing the most authentic Disney experiences I've ever seen. And yes, we're paying for it.
Yes.
It, you know, it's not cheap, but it was literally, we all loved that vacation so much. And it's because of things like Castaway Key and just that multi-generational nature of the brand, that my parents were like in hog heaven, the kids were in hog heaven, we were happy. There's nothing else like it. I'd still be there today. I mean, you listened to the book. I would still be in that job today.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had one bad boss, I would still be at Disney today. There's no doubt. I would have retired from Disney. There's no doubt in my life.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think it's so funny the roads that, right, there's these diverging pathways that come and sometimes we don't know what's going to come, what's going to bloom on the other pathway. I also think it's just I'd love to hear a little bit about what it's like to be a published author. I self-published. I did it kind of through the Amazon Kindle, you know, direct publishing is what they call it. And that in
same
itself
thing
is,
we're all published. Published.
It was such a fascinating experience to learn, but I'm also curious from the standpoint of like, you and I are very similar in the sense that you're very driven, as am I. Mm-hmm. And you talk about this in the book, how like we have a level of quality and expectation of ourselves and a level of pursuit as well. And I hear you talking about it a little bit, which is like, maybe you're going to go start this amazing curated bookstore experience that the world needs, Yes. But you're driven. I'm driven. Like, how does it feel now that I remember somebody asked me what was like the day after this book came out, and I said I felt lighter than I've ever felt.
Oh God, yeah.
Because like you, this came about. This was a collection of 20 years of journals that were in translucent container store boxes that I kept Target. Saying to myself,
"What kept am I moving them do? Around?
Move I know what I'm going to do with again. Them." Yeah,
I know. I remember I showed it to my nieces because I'm like, "These are really going to be valuable to you when I'm gone. Like, you're really going to learn a lot." But no, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you self-publish or work, like, it's just there's milestones in writing a book, right? So the first draft being completed, right, and accepted, and then, you know, the final draft being turned in, and then the day I got the box of like 10 books.
Unboxing
and the smell, you know, because I talk about, we talked about bookstores. I love the smell of books. So like the smell of your own book and like holding in your hands.
Yeah.
The first time you walk into a store and see it on a shelf.
Yeah.
All of that has been overwhelming. But honestly, the best part is meeting people like you, meeting people on the road. Whether they've listened to the book, bought the book, borrowed the book. Now it's in libraries. People told me it's in some libraries. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm in libraries. That they found something in it. That's the whole thing I wanted. It's like, I wanted, you know, any reader, like if they found one or two little pearls of wisdom and the conversations that it opens up. And I don't think I realized how life-changing it was going to be. I think I was like, okay, I wrote the book. I'm super proud of it. It was cathartic. To your point, I felt like I lost a lot of weight. And I was like, okay, on to the next thing, right? And then all of a sudden I was like, no, this has opened up a platform for change. This has opened up a platform for discussion. People need to talk about authenticity. People need to talk about authentic leadership. People need to talk about psychological safety and, you know, positive work cultures. And that really, you know, is what I've morphed into now. I didn't plan it. I think that's one of the things I talk about in the book. Like, I had a plan and I'm driven and I'm ambitious, but I also was open to possibility and things that presented themselves. And I feel like now it's presenting itself and I just have to keep going. Right. And, and I want to do another book and, you know, I've learned stuff in every book event I've done. I've learned stuff from the questions that were asked or the comments that were made. And I was like, I could go
deeper.
There's a whole nother book. I could go deeper over there. And wow, that's an interesting topic. And I've also met some incredible people. I mean, like you, where I'm like, I could do collaborations, other authors, people who represent different parts of the community, you know, other colors of the flag, as I say. Yes. And I'm like, oh, maybe there's something we could do together. And I love that kind of waking up in the morning and being like, what's possible? Yeah. You know, and for me, you know, I turned 59 in 2 weeks. 2025 is the big 6-0. The zero birthdays and the five birthdays mean a lot to me.
Yeah.
Because I'm an Aries, we love our birthdays, number one. Yes. Any Aries in your life, all your listeners know they love their birthdays.
But you don't like surprises.
I hate surprises.
So don't even think about it.
No, I know. But God bless anybody that tries because I'm going to freak them out. But to me, it's like New Year's, right? My birthday is like New Year's. I don't like New Year's Eve, which I talked about in the book. It's not my favorite holiday. But my birthday is one of my favorite holidays. But to me, it's like when I do my review, like I write my review on myself and I look back on the year and I do feel this like moving in. I don't want to be morbid. It's not like the final chapter, but I feel like this moving, like this next decade. So 60 to 70, I think this is what I need to be doing. And it doesn't mean I'm not still going to consult and coach and all those kind of things.
Sure.
But I feel it.
I love that. There's probably a name you probably know of, Chip Connolly.
The modern elders. I can't wait to meet him in person. Yeah. Like he's one that I'm on a mission that again, you find those people, like when you start putting yourself out there in this world of authorship, yeah. particularly queer authorship and owning your age and owning your authenticity. Like I found him on LinkedIn and other people were like, oh, you have to follow, you know, and his, I love what he's doing with the Modern Elder Academy.
Yeah.
The story he's shared about his own journey with health battles. And there's just so many, I've met so many incredible people. Like, and I've met him, but I haven't physically met him. I physically met a gentleman named Fabrice Hodart 2 weeks ago in New York, who is also somebody that, and he's all about LGBTQ+ representation in the boardroom and on boards of directors. Yeah. And so I went to one of his events and that was phenomenal. And again, the book opened all this up. Like if I hadn't done the book, I don't know if I would have run into these people.
Yeah. I would love for you to share your analogy about change, because obviously I've been leading people through change.
Everybody loves this one.
So can you share that? And then one last thing I would love to do before we wrap up at the end. Mm-hmm. I would actually love to read you one of my poems from my first book called, and the title is actually called What is Pride?
Oh so, my God, I'd be so honored. I can't wait. I'm gonna get teary. So I feel it coming.
It might.
You want me to tell the train story,
yes,
right?
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, so many people love that. Maybe the next book is all about this, but I write in the book that change is inevitable, right? And change is hard for everybody to deal with. And working in retail and working in media and entertainment, we were constantly changing because the consumer was changing, the competitive marketplace was changing. And I realized as I grew as a leader, I had to help people manage change more effectively.
Yeah.
And actually, when I was at Disney, one of the skills that we look for, we called it change agent, like were they ability to be a change agent. So the story is, I would tell people, like, you know, to me, change, probably because I spent too much time in Europe, like you, like change is like you're standing in a train station and the train is leaving the station and you have the choice. Do you get on the engine and actually drive the change? Do you get on first class and participate positively in the change? Maybe you're the person who gets on the second class car. Maybe you're still standing on the platform and you see like that luggage car coming. You're like, oh, I better get on. There's the luggage. Then, you know, maybe you're the person that finally gets on the caboose as the caboose is coming up. Or you're like, I'm going to get on and I'm actually going to put the coal in the engine. Like I'm going to stoke the engine. I'm going to work the change. Or you're waving at the train as it leaves the station. There's people who are still left on the platform. And I would say to teams, I'm comfortable with you being any of that.
Right.
However, I encourage you to get on the train. Because if you do not at least get on the train, in my mind, then you're a victim of the change. And not participating in the change. And I understand you may not all want to be the leader of the change, but at least participate by getting on the train, even on the caboose, you're riding the change. You're not just standing and waving at it. Because if you think by not participating, the change is not going to happen, then you have a huge amount of arrogance because you cannot control the change. And so, and it's always around, of course, I would always have to use this story around layoffs or reorganizations or job eliminations. But the reality was, and I think you understand and readers understood, it was going to happen whether you got on the train or not.
Yeah.
I think part of, again, how I grew up is I just never wanted to be the victim, right? And I think this is part of the ACOA thing, Bill, is like, I refused to be a victim of my mother's disease, refused.
Yeah.
And people that play the victim, I don't do well with, right? Because I'm like, okay, buck up here. Like, okay, I feel sorry for you and you're allowed to feel sorry for yourself, but you can't just swallow in this pity. And that's the way I felt about the change. That's the train story is.
I love it.
I just, and again, I wasn't looking, not everybody can be on the engine. I wasn't expecting everybody to jump on right away. I just was like, get on the train. Like, and I wanted people, you know, the management story was I wanted people to get on the train. If you were a person that was waving for the platform, we were probably going to have some issues because that to me was being a victim.
Yeah. Or at least get on the bar car, like
bar car, do something like, be the one hanging off the back that you ran to catch up with it, like a Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah.
But just don't be left on the platform. Yeah. Like, and that was my thing.
I love that analogy. It's so simple and something that people can relate to. I also
visual. I think people need visual.
They do. And I also love the fact that you mentioned, you know, this kind of came about when there's change that is unanticipated. So
totally.
For me, I've actually been through two layoffs in my life. And what's really interesting is this book only came about because of my last layoff. So Microsoft laid off my entire team. Yeah. And what did I do with the grief? What did I do? Did I play victim? No, I actually went back and read 20 years of poems and journals and said, wow, this is really helpful to me. And then I was like, if it was helpful to me, Jim, like maybe it's helpful to somebody else. And
no, that's the thing is you weren't a victim. Like,
that's right.
That's awesome.
So
okay, read it to me. I'm
with
dying.
That,
I'm
okay, gonna, here we go. This
close
is
close my eyes and listen.
This is page 65. And this is
the
titled,
year I was born. That's a good year.
Oh, interesting. Look at that. Titled, What is Pride? You call it a month. I call it a movement. Some see a party. Others a riot. What does it mean to commemorate, to liberate, and to debate? Hand me a megaphone. I've got something to state. There are brothers and sisters dying alone still today. So why are we arguing over the birthplace of gay? Your block, my block, our home, these hearts. Historic heartbreak, just like love, never fades. Legal judgments alone won't save the day. Because in some states, you cannot be born this way. Political or corporate, individual or collective, protest or rave, local, national, global, don't tell me how to behave. In the year 1978, on this very day, hands raised, the rainbow flag in the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day parade. Let us not forget how far we've come and how much there is to be done. When the unjust no longer reigns, and every heart is full of light, only then will I close my eyes and rest, truly rest, with fear out of sight.
My God, that's beautiful. That's beautiful, Bill. Incredible.
That was a rebellious act that I wrote one year because I got tired of explaining. And the 100%. Accidental advocate came out in me. And
that's what I'm saying. You're an activist. You're an advocate because you're living your life authentically. We all are. And we have to share those stories. No, I think that's beautiful. I love that you do it through poetry.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me share.
That's amazing. Of
1965, page 65.
Page 65. It's so ironic. Yeah.
I know. Well, thank you so much for this time. This was such a joy. I can't wait for you to go to Denmark and have that amazing
trip. I know. I had my 21st birthday there.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to have my 59th birthday there. So 38 years later, I'm going to celebrate a birthday in Denmark again.
I'm returning to Poland after 32 years in a couple months. I lived there for 2 years and as from 12 to 14 years old, and I'll be returning to Poland to basically go just look at the places we lived and take my husband there and
feel the roots.
Like this is where I started kind of becoming who I was.
Well, 12 to 14 are pivotal years in anybody's life,
especially behind the Iron Curtain, my friend.
I was gonna say that's a huge adolescence, puberty, teenage.
There's a book in there called Adolescence Behind the Iron Curtain.
I was gonna say you've got a book there for sure.
So, well, thank you so much for the time. Enjoy your weekend. Be safe. And thanks so much for everything, for writing this, for sharing it. Thank you, Jill. Thank you, Mama. Thank you, all these people.
She'll love that. More call outs for Jill. I can't wait. She'll listen. She listens to all of them. She'll love it. It's about her.
Good. Awesome. All right. Well,
thanks.
Let me know if you never need anything. And if you're ever in the Pacific Northwest, up in Seattle region,
My niece is there. My goddaughter's there, and I owe her a visit. And she's getting ready to move into a little house with a roommate. So and I haven't done a book event yet in Seattle. So it's on the list.
You let us know. You've got a home cooked meal and lots of long conversations surrounded by books here when you do.
So kind.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you.